Harper Audio presents The Trillion Dollar Conspiracy, How the New World Order, Man-Made Diseases, and Zombie Banks Are Destroying America, by Jim Mars, read by John Pruden. Copyright 2010 by Jim Mars. Production copyright 2010 by HarperCollins Publishers. Introduction. Single acts of tyranny may be ascribed to the accidental opinion of the day, but a series of oppressions begun at the distinguished period and pursued unalterably through every change of ministers too plainly proves a deliberate, systematic plan of reducing us to slavery. Thomas Jefferson. Today, Jefferson's words might read, "An occasional act of tyranny may be excused as a momentary lapse of judgment by officials, but a continuous series of such acts pursued through both Democratic and Republican administrations clearly proves there is a deliberate and systematic plan to reduce once free Americans to slavery." To be a zombie is to exist under the most onerous bonds of slavery, bonds that allow for no thought to one's actions. Zombies are controlled both mentally and physically by some outside force, whether through a virus causing them to seek blood or voodoo magic. A zombie is neither dead nor alive, and usually under the control of someone else, as in the old Hollywood films. Zombies stumble about, largely unaware of the world around them, intent on purposes that others have created for them through alchemy or electromagnetism. In old horror movies, actors Bela Lugosi and John Carradine controlled zombies, causing them to commit acts that ran against human nature. And now zombies are everywhere. They're highly popular grists for movies, books, comics, and computer games. Is it just a coincidence that zombies are so popular? Or is it possible that Americans like zombies because they offer us a reflection of how we perceive ourselves as barely alive and living mindlessly? Many individuals today stumble through their daily chores without caring or knowing why they do so. These people might be numbed by drugs or the incessant bombardment by the broadcast media. But whatever the case, many Americans seem like zombies in so many ways. The term zombie is being applied to more and more aspects of life in modern America. Adderall is one of the most popular of the faddish new psychiatric drugs to combat attention deficit / hyperactivity disorder. This drug consists of equal amounts of the stimulants amphetamine and dextroamphetamine. In fact, ADHDtreatment.org describes a side effect of Adderall as zombie demeanor. The word zombie has so pervaded our society that it has worked its way into the scientific community's lexicon. In mid-May 2009, researchers at the University of Texas and Texas A&M's AgriLife Extension Service in East Texas reported that they had found a way to control the state's fire ant infestation. They discovered that the tiny forid fly, a native of the South American region where the fire ants in Texas originated, could dive bomb the ants and lay eggs on them. The eggs would hatch inside the ants and eat away their brains, turning them into what scientists called zombie ants. The ants would wander aimlessly for about 2 weeks until their heads fell off. Not only does the word describe how we view our own existence, but it has, and can still be, applied to the dissolution of the pillars of our society, most notably our banks. During the recent financial fiasco, the banks whose liabilities exceeded their assets were called zombie banks. As author Bill Sardi, a regular contributor to LouRockwell.com, explained, zombie banks are defined as a financial institution with an economic net worth that is less than zero, but which continues to operate because its ability to repay its debts is shored up by implicit or explicit government credit support. In a sense, they were dead but still going through the motions of life. America is now confronted with an economic situation that is being compared to the Great Depression, and the only solutions seem to lie in aggregating debt, deflating the value of the dollar, and moving riches around. Not only that, but the scale of our economic problems has vastly increased. On October 1, 2008, the national debt was $10 trillion. But during 2009, it climbed to nearly $12 trillion, the single largest increase in a year. If every American man, woman, and child were to liquidate every asset he or she owns, the total could not equal this debt. The term trillion is bandied about lightly by the mass media, yet most people cannot truly conceive of the significance of such a number. A trillion square miles would encompass 3.7 million states the size of Texas, which covers approximately 270,000 square miles. $1 trillion, on the other hand, could be made of $1 bills stretching all the way to our sun and back. If banking institutions that operate at a deficit are called zombie banks, then couldn't we call a country whose debts exceed its assets a zombie nation? And perhaps this epithet could also be applied to its citizens. In 2008, many saw the nation turn from national socialism to Marxist socialism when the totalitarian Bush administration turned over power to the Obama administration, an administration that favors socialist Medicare policies and redistributions of wealth. America's zombies now face a further loss of individual freedoms due to corrupt politics, corporate malfeasance, and legislation that continues to curtail individual freedom. As readers of Rule by Secrecy and The Rise of the Fourth Reich will understand, the global financiers, the global plutocrats of Wall Street, London, and Switzerland, have manipulated Western history for at least the past century. First, by creating the Federal Reserve in America by deceitful political machinations, then communism in Russia by funding the Bolsheviks rather than the White Russians, and followed by financing National Socialism, the Nazis, in Germany. Now these global financiers have taken control of the United States and are changing it in such ways that we now live in a society unimaginable to citizens of just two decades ago. For instance, in the 1950s, Ronald Reagan publicly warned against socialized medicine. Today, the argument is just how socialized it will be. The information highway is a traffic jam of hype, misinformation, disinformation, distractions, and propaganda. New attempts to transform technology, healthcare, education, and the political system are being reported every day. More and more Americans have been forced to focus on the dark side of contemporary life. Now, we live under the tyranny of a new world order, a world that has been reordered by a small group of wealthy financiers and industrialists, centered within secret societies such as the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, and the Bilderberg Group. Also, one must consider how this new world has become more and more a surveillance society and police state, existing under a financially unstable infrastructure and fed by corporations that hold monopolies on food, water, and drugs. Are we living in a fascist government? Possibly. The American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language defines fascism as a philosophy or system of government that advocates or exercises a dictatorship of the extreme right, typically through the merging of state and business leadership together with an ideology of belligerent nationalism. Today, of course, the dictatorship would be of the extreme left, but nevertheless would include the power of both the government and the corporations that have their hands in public affairs. Many people today believe the United States is going to hell in a handbasket, that the United States is no longer a vibrant republic based on constitutional law, but rather a brain-dead and decaying empire being taken over by an entrenched financial elite who seek a worldwide socialist order to dominate. This belief grows among Americans as they read the daily headlines and listen to the electronic mass media. People are seeking true change, not mere political rhetoric, but they feel befuddled as they can't understand who precisely has hijacked their country. Some Americans are acting out. In tea parties and in a massive demonstration in Washington on September 12, 2009, tens of thousands of Americans displayed their dissatisfaction with where the nation is going. What does one call a country that seems to be merely mimicking the robust republic it used to be, whose population has been dumbed down by controversial educational programs, drugged out by an ever-growing pharmaceutical industry, and frightened into submission by constant threats of terrorism and economic collapse? Would this not be a zombie nation? A nation that goes through the motions in commerce, politics, health, and education, but without a spark of life, verve, or enthusiasm? This is the true horror story. What happened? How did the nation get this way? Was it simply a case of inattention by the electorate? The natural evolution of a society grown prosperous and complacent? Overreaching greed and lust for profit by corporate leaders? Or could it have been a conspiracy? Part 1. A Zombie Nation. I see in the near future a crisis approaching that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of my country. As a result of the war, corporations have been enthroned, and an era of corruption in high places will follow, and the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until all wealth is aggregated in a few hands and the republic is destroyed. Attributed to Abraham Lincoln. Economic decline. Times are tough for America. Thanks to what Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner called the failure of America's financial system, by the start of 2010, more than $5 trillion of household wealth had evaporated. About one in every eight mortgages was in default or foreclosure. It is predicted that there will be 10 million foreclosures on homes through 2012. One in every eight adults and one in four children now subsist on government food stamps. All of these problems were exacerbated by high rates of unemployment. According to an Associated Press report, one in every five Americans is unemployed or underemployed, with the number expected to rise in 2010, causing the second highest unemployment figure since World War II. Dissension and dissatisfaction are widespread, and they're linked to the poor economy. If the economy were the hands of a zombie, those hands would be bound by debt. Charles K. Rowley is a professor of economics at George Mason University and general director of the Locke Institute in Fairfax, Virginia. He's widely considered to be a major voice in political and economic thought. In an article for the United Kingdom's Daily Telegraph, Rowley wrote, "The U.S. economy suffers from a growing culture of indebtedness that has increasingly contaminated the federal government since 2001. And has spilled over dramatically into private household behavior." He also raised a popular question asking, if excessive government indebtedness is a major source of the problem, why increase the government debt? Why encourage households to go yet further into debt? Ominously, Rowley predicted, It is not impossible that the U.S. will experience the kind of economic collapse from first to third world status experienced by Argentina under the National Socialist governance of Juan Perón. In other words, if the U.S. government cannot find ways of living within its means, as most families are forced to do, the nation may fall into third world status, complete with scarcities of food and water, consumer goods, and socialized government control. One of the barely noticed aspects of the financial crisis is the substantial drop in tax revenues. Even as the Obama administration and Congress spend more money to stimulate the economy. According to CNN, through the end of August 2009, the federal government collected 25% less tax revenue than for the same 8-month period in 2008. The Congressional Budget Office predicted tax receipts would fall to 14% of the gross domestic product, a sharp decline from the historical average of 18.3%. Additionally, individual income tax revenues fell 20%, while corporate income taxes dropped a whopping 56%. Predictions for 2010 were not much better. And the loss of governmental revenue has filtered down to local governments. Increasing unemployment has caused 32 state unemployment insurance trust funds to fall below the recommended federal level, indicating these states will require massive federal loans to continue assistance for the jobless. Officials in Vigo County, Indiana, announced in mid-2009 that they could no longer afford to bury a dead person if that dead person had no savings, insurance, or family money set aside for a funeral. In Atlanta, citizens groups have tried to stop city plans to demolish its remaining public housing units. More than 20 counties in Michigan have reverted paved roads to gravel in an effort to save money, according to the County Road Association of Michigan. The Wall Street Journal has reported that 90% of all U.S. businesses are family-owned or controlled. The financial crisis has forced many to close their doors. In fact, the Bureau of Labor Statistics estimated between the fourth quarter of 2007 and the fourth quarter of 2008, some 4 million firms with 19 or fewer employees went out of business. The American public in 2009 managed to actually increase their savings, but runaway deficit spending by the government undermined their efforts. Peter Schiff, the author of Crash Proof, explained, "The simple truth is that government debt is our debt. So if a family manages at some cost to their lifestyle to squirrel away an extra $1,000 in savings this year, but the government adds $20,000 in new debt per household, each family's approximate share of the $1.8 trillion fiscal 2009 deficit, that family ends up owing $19,000 more than they did at the beginning of the year." Socialism and loss of individuality. Socialism is a key word in understanding what has happened to America. Most dictionaries define socialism as the collective ownership and administration of the means of production and distribution of goods and services. Invariably, a centralized authority is needed to administer these means. The communist leader, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, foresaw a workers' paradise where each person will be voluntarily engaged in work according to his capacities, and each will freely take according to his needs. But, as Lenin noted, before a person could freely take from the state, that person must become subordinate to the state. "All our lives we fought against exalting the individual," said Lenin, espousing the same agenda of the early-day Western globalists who funded the Bolsheviks during the Russian Revolution of 1917. Lenin proclaimed, "The aim of socialism is not only to abolish the present division of mankind into small states and all-national isolation, not only to bring the nations closer to each other, but also to merge them." He also may have foreseen the methods being used to bring down the American Republic when he said, The surest way to destroy a nation is to debauch its currency. And give me 4 years to teach the children, and the seed I have sown will never be uprooted. As former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury Paul Craig Roberts stated in a treatise on the first principles of freedom, a person born before the turn of the 20th century was born a private individual. He was born into a world in which his existence was attested by his mere physical presence, without documents, forms, permits, licenses, orders, lists of currency carried in and out, identity cards, draft cards, ration cards, exit stamps, customs declarations, questionnaires, tax forms, reports in multiplicate, social security number, or other authentications of his being, birth, nationality, status, beliefs, creed, right to be, enter, leave, move about, work, trade, purchase, dwell. Many people take private individuals for granted, and they will find what I am saying far-fetched. But private individuals do not exist in the Soviet Union or in China, where the claims of the state are total, and even art and literature must be subservient to the interests of the state. Roberts presented an example of how bureaucracy has begun to erode the liberties of American citizens. In the 1970s, U.S. District Judge Wilbur Owens instructed the Board of Regents of the University System of Georgia to use involuntary transfers of faculty members between system institutions to achieve racial balance among the faculties. As long as the involuntary transfers of teachers was intra-city and confined to elementary and high school teachers, my liberal colleagues saw it as social progress. But once they faced inter-city involuntary transfers, they called it fascism. It is true that until the liberal progress of the 1960s, government direction of labor in this century was unique to the Hitler and Stalin regimes. As is often the case, people realize the consequences of statist ideas only when their own private individualities are touched. But the fleecing of America did not merely start in the 1970s. It's been going on for many more decades. Consider a 1934 editorial cartoon published in the Chicago Tribune entitled Planned Economy or Planned Destruction. In the drawing, there are men identified as young pinkies from Columbia and Harvard who are shoveling money from a cart. Beneath the cart sits a disheveled Leon Trotsky writing, Plan of Action for U.S. Spend, spend, spend under the guise of recovery. Bust the government. Blame the capitalists for the failure. Junk the Constitution and declare a dictatorship. This cartoon might well have been drawn by a conservative cartoonist of today. A few older citizens may recall the words of Norman Mattoon Thomas, a pacifist who ran for president 6 times between 1928 and 1948 under the Socialist Party of America banner. The American people will never knowingly adopt socialism, he said, but under the name of liberalism, they will adopt every fragment of the socialist program, until one day America will be a socialist nation, without knowing how it happened. In a 1948 interview, Thomas said he was retiring from American politics because both the Democratic and Republican parties had adopted every plank of the socialists' platform, and there was no longer a need for the alternative socialist party. If Thomas was possibly correct in 1948, he is undoubtedly correct now. Many people see what was once termed creeping socialism in the United States, now full-blown policy in Washington. This perception was reflected on the February 16, 2009 cover of Newsweek that declared, "We are all socialists now." Many Americans cringed at the nationalization of the banking and auto industries. They feared more would follow. Tea parties. Beginning in April 2009, protests against out-of-control government spending, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the squabble over health care spread nationwide in citizen meetings termed tea parties. The name came from the original Boston Tea Party of 1773, when American colonists tossed shipments of tea into Boston Harbor in protest of the British government's taxation without representation. Many modern wits have pointed out, if the colonists thought taxation without representation was bad, they should see taxation with representation. In 2009, the spirit of protest spilled over into several town hall meetings, where members of Congress, off for the summer recess, were shouted at and, in some cases, chased from the hall by constituents angered by what they saw as President Obama's socialist health care plan and general government malfeasance. This groundswell of public protest continued into 2010, with even more tea parties and demonstrations of anger over perceived socialist giveaway programs, the health care crisis, corporate bailouts, and the destruction of the U.S. economy, all of which will be discussed later. New World Order. Many concerned citizens turned to alternative radio talk shows and internet blogs to learn more about a plan by globalists to control the world, one that President George H.W. Bush called the New World Order. It's a term that Adolf Hitler once used. Self-styled globalists are those people who believe themselves above petty nationalism. These men and women deal with the planet Earth as their sphere of influence. Many view the United States as a not-so-profitable division of their multinational corporations. Globalists adhere to the old Illuminati philosophy of the end justifies the means, although most would disdain any connection to that elder secret society or the Nazis who carried this philosophy to its political extremes. In the book Shadow Elite, Janine Waddell described globalists as Flexians, members of a transnational elite, the mover and shaker who serves at one and the same time as business consultant, think tanker, TV pundit, and government advisor, and glides in and around the organizations that enlist his services. It is not just his time that is divided. His loyalties, too, are often flexible. Despite the scoffs of Flexians within the corporate mass media and bought-off politicians, the New World Order does exist, and it often makes far-reaching plans. President T. Woodrow Wilson wrote that the bulk of money sent to Russia from the United States at the time of the Russian Revolution went to the Bolsheviks, the forerunners of the communists. These funds came from the Rockefellers and other Wall Street capitalists such as Jacob Schiff, Elihu Root, J.P. Morgan, and the Harriman family. W. Averill Harriman became U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union during World War II. These men and others also provided initial funding for the Council on Foreign Relations. When these same globalists became fearful of worldwide communism, they needed separate national or economic blocs to play off against each other for the tensions necessary for maximum profit and control. They supported National Socialism in Germany. German Army intelligence agent Adolf Hitler was funded to provide a bulwark against the communist tide by enlarging his National Socialist German Workers' Party, the Nazis, in turn sowing the seeds of World War II. Three prominent Americans who were instrumental in funding the Nazis were National City Bank, now Citicorp, Chairman John J. McCloy, Schroeder Bank attorneys Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles, and Prescott Bush, a director of Union Banking Corporation and the Hamburg America Shipping Line. It is interesting to note that following World War II, McCloy became the High Commissioner of Occupied Germany. John Foster Dulles became President Eisenhower's Secretary of State. Alan Dulles became the longest-serving CIA director. And Bush, as a senator from Connecticut, was instrumental in forming the CIA. It might also be noted that both McCloy and Alan Dulles sat on the largely discredited Warren Commission assigned by President Lyndon B. Johnson to investigate the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. After World War II, the globalist agenda was advanced by the creation of the United Nations. An earlier attempt to create a transnational organization, the League of Nations, failed because the U.S. Senate thought that ratification would end American sovereignty. Nick Rockefeller, a participant in the World Economic Forum and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, may have revealed the agenda of the New World Order in a casual comment. According to the late Hollywood producer Aaron Russo, Rockefeller told him, "The end goal is to get everybody chipped, to control the whole society, to have the bankers and the elite people control the world." Catherine Austin Fitz, Assistant Secretary of Housing during the George H.W. Bush presidency, wrote in early 2009, "In the fall of 2001, I attended a private investment conference in London to give a paper, The Myth of the Rule of Law, or How the Money Works, The Destruction of Hamilton Securities Group. The presentation documented my experience with a Washington Wall Street partnership that had engineered a fraudulent housing and debt bubble, illegally shifted vast amounts of capital out of the U.S., used privatization as a form of piracy, a pretext to move government assets to private investors at below market prices, and then shift private liabilities back to government at no cost to the private liability holder. Other presenters at the conference included distinguished reporters covering privatization in Eastern Europe and Russia. As the portraits of British ancestors stared down upon us, we listened to story after story of global privatization throughout the 1990s in the Americas, Europe, and Asia." Fitz reiterated Rockefeller's statement about a new world order ruled by a global elite. She noted, "As the pieces fit together, we shared a horrifying epiphany. The banks, corporations, and investors acting in each global region were the exact same players. They were a relatively small group that reappeared again and again in Russia, Eastern Europe, and Asia, accompanied by the same well-known accounting firms and law firms. Clearly, there was a global financial coup d'etat underway." Walter Cronkite, the legendary anchor of CBS News, often referred to as the most trusted man in America, also stated his belief that the country was ruled by a small elite. Shortly before his death in July 2009, Cronkite was asked if there was a ruling class in America. "I'm afraid that there is," he replied. "I don't think it serves the democracy well, but that is true. I think there is. The ruling class is the rich who really command our industry, our commerce, our finance. And those people are able to so manipulate our democracy that they really control the democracy, I feel." With the bulk of the public both manipulated and distracted by political parties and the corporate mass media, no one seems capable of discerning, much less opposing, this new world order of elitists with corporate, family, and class connections and common interests. Until the real rulers of America are identified and confronted, no amount of hand-wringing, letter-writing, or demonstrating can have any meaningful effect. Dissension in the ranks. The financial calamity of 2008 exposed the New World Order to be in slight disarray even before it was firmly established. Though the Obama administration is rife with men and women well connected to the centers of wealth and power, as will be seen, control over both the economic and social conditions in the United States appeared to be getting out of their hands. There was even dissension in the ranks at the University of Chicago, which many consider to be the center of globalist thinking. The university's 1995 Nobel Memorial Prize winner in economic sciences, Robert E. Lucas, claimed the Obama administration's stimulus plans are schlock economics, while his colleague, professor of finance John H. Cochran, stated they were based on discredited fairy tales. Their cry was reminiscent of the term voodoo economics used by George H.W. Bush against Ronald Reagan's free enterprise plans during the Republican presidential primaries in 1980. Paul Krugman, a New York Times op-ed columnist and winner of the 2008 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences, wrote, "As I see it, the economics profession went astray because economists, as a group, mistook beauty, clad in impressive-looking mathematics, for truth. Until the Great Depression, most economists clung to a vision of capitalism as a perfect or nearly perfect system. That vision wasn't sustainable in the face of mass unemployment. But as memories of the Depression faded, economists fell back in love with the old idealized vision of an economy in which rational individuals interact in perfect markets, this time gussied up with fancy equations. The central cause of the profession's failure was the desire for an all-encompassing, intellectually elegant approach that also gave economists a chance to show off their mathematical prowess. Unfortunately, this romanticized and sanitized vision of the economy led most economists to ignore all the things that can go wrong. They turned a blind eye to the limitations of human rationality that often lead to bubbles and busts, to the problems of institutions that run amok, to the imperfections of markets, especially financial markets, that can cause the economy's operating system to undergo sudden, unpredictable crashes, and to the dangers created when regulators don't believe in regulation." Conspiracy theorists have long been ridiculed for their claims that the Great Depression was manufactured by globalist bankers. Krugman added much weight to that argument with a narrative involving a statement by the current chairman of the Fed's Board of Governors, Ben Bernanke. At a 90th birthday celebration for Milton Friedman, Ben Bernanke declared of the Great Depression, "You're right, we did it. We're very sorry. But thanks to you, it won't happen again." The clear message was that all you need to avoid depressions is a smarter Fed. So we see that a plan is in play to debase the U.S. economy and impose a socialist system. Whether Obama's Marxist socialism or Bush's National Socialism apparently makes no difference to those wealthy or powerful enough to control the central bureaucracy of the state. These globalists, who have manipulated world history for decades, if not centuries, are working a plan to turn the once free and prosperous Republic of the United States into a socialist state populated by dumbed down and destitute zombies by draining dry the nation's money supply. It is truly a trillion-dollar conspiracy.